Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, and Justice Ridgely. It's a pleasure to see you all today. My name is Patricia Anario, and I represent the appellant Wimbledon Fund LP. The issue on this appeal is whether the Court of Chancery properly determined, as a matter of law, that SV did not consent to Wimbledon's withdrawal as of June 30, 2008. The court below ruled as a matter of law based on a letter that it referred to as deeply ambiguous and a situation that it described as sloppy. Just want to give your honors a brief factual background. Wimbledon invested in SV on October 7, 2008. On February 21, 2008, it sent a withdrawal notice pursuant to Section 6.1 of the Limited Partnership Agreement. It was seeking a full redemption of its interest effective June 30, 2008. The Limited Partnership Agreement provides for a one-year lockup, but it did not preclude Wimbledon from submitting its withdrawal notice on February 21st, even if the one-year lockup was still in effect. The one-year lockup was not ironclad. Section 6.1A of the Limited Partnership Agreement states that the general partner, in its sole discretion, may consent to withdrawals as of other dates. In other words, Wimbledon was perfectly within its rights when it submitted its withdrawal notice on February 21st. Section 6.1F of the Limited Partnership Agreement states that the general partner may, in its sole discretion, waive or modify the terms relating to withdrawals pursuant to written agreement with a limited partner or otherwise. The Limited Partnership Agreement does not mandate one method or form of consent. The issue on this...
So the right you're referring to is the right to ask for the discretion to be exercised as opposed to a right to withdraw, period.
Yes. The issue on this appeal was whether correspondence that SV sent to Wimbledon on September 30th presented an issue of fact as to whether SV had consented to Wimbledon's early withdrawal. In the September 30th letter, SV referred to the June 30th, 2008 withdrawal date in the first paragraph and then stated that the general partner has determined that the aforementioned withdrawal, that is the June 30th, 2008 withdrawal, be made on an in-kind basis and that SV would provide more detailed notice as to the time and the securities to be delivered. Based on this letter, consent was a permissible inference that could reasonably be drawn from the evidence. To hold otherwise ignores SV's proposal to pay the redemption amount in kind and to provide details as to the delivery and type of securities. SV's letter is even more remarkable for what it does not say. It does not say that Wimbledon did not have a right to withdraw as of June 30, 2008. It does not say that due to the one-year waiting period, Wimbledon's withdrawal would have to be effective December 30th and not June 30th. In fact, SV never mentioned December 31, 2008. SV also states in the September letter that Wimbledon could change its mind about withdrawing if it did not want payment in kind. Wimbledon did not change its mind about the withdrawal. On October 31, SV sent a letter suspending all redemptions. After Wimbledon received the October 31 suspension letter, it contacted SV to confirm that it was going to recognize Wimbledon as a creditor effective June 30, 2008. SV refused to recognize Wimbledon's creditor status because it had suspended all redemptions, not because of the one-year lockup. Wimbledon filed this action and sought a declaratory judgment that it is a creditor of SV with a debt amount equal to the net asset value of its interest as of June 30, 2008. SV answered the complaint, and it did not raise the one-year lockup in its answer. The only thing SV mentioned is that the withdrawal was precluded by the October 31 suspension letter. The parties thereafter filed motions for summary judgment. The Court of Chancery addressed two issues in its summary judgment decision: whether SV consented to Wimbledon's withdrawal as of June 30, 2008, in the September letter, and whether SV's decision to suspend withdrawals applied to Wimbledon. The court granted SV's motion for summary judgment and held that there was no triable issue of fact as to whether the September letter reflected SV's consent to Wimbledon's withdrawal effective June 30, 2008.
Does the term express waiver come into play here at any point? In construing the letter. Let's assume the letter's ambiguous and more important for what it does not explicitly say than what it does say. Even so, there was a 12-month lockup. Where is the language that suggests that it had been waived, that there was an express waiver of the 12-month lockup?
There's no express language in the letter that says anything about the lockup.
Doesn't there have to be?
No. I think there only has to be sufficient evidence to show that there is a possibility that SV waived the lockup, whether there's an issue of fact as to whether SV waived the lockup. I think requiring us to present clear and probative evidence on summary judgment regarding a waiver supplants the standard for waiver with the standard for summary judgment. And that's inconsistent with the precedent of this court, where it's held that waiver intention forms the basis for waiver. And intention and waiver are issues that are not subject to summary judgment.
Well, is there any language in the agreement itself, in the limited partnership agreement, that suggests how express the waiver must be?
Well, the only the section 6.1F does deal with the withdrawals and how the general partner may, in its sole discretion, waive or modify the terms relating to withdrawals. And that provision says that it should be pursuant to a written agreement with a limited partner or otherwise, which we think the or otherwise opens the door for this type of letter to show that SV had consented to the early withdrawal.
Well, if I understand the Vice Chancellor's ruling, it was that the language was not ambiguous, and if you read it for what it said, it didn't constitute a waiver. How did he get that wrong?
Well, the Vice Chancellor said in his opinion that it was not ambiguous, but during the oral argument, he described the letter as deeply ambiguous, and he also described the entire situation
as
sloppy.
All right, he's deeply inconsistent. But in his final opinion, regardless of what he said at oral argument, didn't he determine it was not ambiguous and therefore could not constitute a waiver?
He determined that it was not ambiguous, that we had not satisfied our burden for a waiver on summary judgment because the language was not clear in the letter and that there was not an express waiver. And then he also, but we think that he made that determination based on factual determinations that he was not required to make on a summary judgment motion. For example,
you mean factual determinations he was not allowed to make.
Right, exactly. He said, the 1 year was about to expire, and so the only plausible inference is that they were going to allow a December 31 withdrawal. Well, how can he make that determination on summary judgment? Whereas we have another plausible interpretation that says, look, the first paragraph says June 30th. It then says we'll make the redemption in kind. We'll get back to you as to what kind of securities and when that will be done. I mean, isn't that just as plausible that SV was going to honor June 30th as the determination that, well, the 1 year was coming up in 8 days or whatever it was, and so they really meant December 30th. December 30th isn't even mentioned, or December 31 isn't even mentioned in the letter at all. Only June 30th is. So that's our argument for why we think that that summary judgment was improperly granted. SV makes an argument in their brief that the issue of fact was not an issue that was properly preserved. However, this issue was fairly presented to the court below, consistent with Supreme Court Rule 8. The court decided whether there was an issue of fact. In fact, the court ruled that Wimbledon had not presented a triable issue of fact as to whether the September 2008 letter constituted SV Fund's retroactive consent to Wimbledon's redemption request. SV also argues that Rule 56H applies and that the cross motions are treated as a stipulation that there is no factual dispute regarding a trial and that neither party receives the benefit of any factual inferences. The parties do not refer to Rule 56H in their briefs. The Court of Chancery did not apply Rule 56H. As a result, we think 56H does not apply here. And moreover, according to its very terms, it doesn't apply because Wimbledon has raised an issue of fact. And even if Rule 56H applies, and we don't think it does, this court has previously reversed the Superior Court when it ruled on cross motions for summary judgment based on an issue of fact. Even though the Superior Court applied its own version of Rule 56H, and the parties had advised the Superior Court that a trial was unnecessary. And that case is Seifert Golf. And in Seifert Golf, this court found that the term plant was susceptible to either or both interpretations that were advocated by the parties. As a result, this court reversed and then remanded the case and noted that the trial court may wish to consider directing the parties to enlarge the record to include testimony of the parties, the persons who had negotiated the documents. The Court of Chancery's task here was to examine the record and determine whether it could find, as a matter of law, that SV did not consent to Wimbledon's early withdrawal. Summary judgment may not be granted when the record indicates a material fact is in dispute, or if it seems desirable to inquire more thoroughly into the facts in order to clarify the application of the law to the circumstances. Summary judgment must also be denied if there is a dispute regarding the inferences which might be drawn from the facts. The court erred by finding that the September letter was too ambiguous to support a waiver by SV of the one-year requirement, despite the express acknowledgement of the June 30, 2008 date, yet not sufficiently ambiguous to preclude summary judgment in SV's favor on the issue of whether the September letter was referring to a June 30th withdrawal date, which is expressly referenced in the letter, or a December 31 withdrawal date, which is mentioned nowhere in the letter. A plausible inference to be drawn from the September letter is that SV intended to honor the June 30th withdrawal date. The court below failed to draw this reasonable inference in Wimbledon's favor. This inference is based on the language of the September 30th letter, which sets forth the June 30th withdrawal date in the first paragraph, and then goes on to provide that the general partner has determined that the aforementioned withdrawal be made on an in-kind basis and that SV will provide detailed notice as to the time of delivery and the securities to be delivered. Despite this language, the Court of Chancery focused on whether the September letter included a clear representation that SV waived the one-year lockup. The court determined that the September 2008 letter did not include a clear representation that SV had waived the one-year requirement and that SV was entitled to summary judgment. The court and SV want to require Wimbledon to conclusively establish that SV consented to Wimbledon's early withdrawal. Wimbledon presented sufficient evidence supporting its position that SV consented to the early withdrawal in the September letter, and that is all that is required. However, the court failed to recognize that there were at least two equally plausible interpretations of the September letter. The court went on to find that the only plausible interpretation of the letter was that SV was acknowledging Wimbledon's redemption request and preparing to effect the withdrawal as of December 31. The September letter does not refer to December 31. The only withdrawal date that is set forth in that letter is June 30th. Even the court below noted during oral argument that the September letter doesn't seem to fixate on the end of the year. Yet the court ignored this very astute observation in its opinion.
December 31st would have been the end of the lockup period?
Well, October would have been the end of the lockup period, but December 31 would have been the next available withdrawal date available to Wimbledon, because the only withdrawal dates were June 30th and December 31. Faced with competing interpretations of the September letter, the court below still found as a matter of law that SV did not waive the one-year lockup. Intention forms the foundation of waiver. As this court held in Aero Global, where the inference or ultimate fact to be established concerns intent or other subjective reaction, summary judgment is ordinarily inappropriate. The court below was focused on clear representations. This case did not involve a clear representation, but that can't mean that SV should win as a matter of law on summary judgment. What it did involve is a letter that can be read to have two meanings, that SV was consenting to the June 30th withdrawal date, and according to SV and the court below, that SV was agreeing to a December 31 withdrawal date. As a result, summary judgment in SV's favor should be reversed. And moving on to the second issue regarding the suspension letter, if this court finds that the Court of Chancery erred when it determined that SV was entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law on the consent issue, then it should also reverse the court's ruling that the October 31 letter suspended Wimbledon's withdrawal. The general partner had the right to suspend withdrawals to partners. We don't dispute that. However, if Wimbledon's withdrawal was effective on June 30, 2008, it was no longer a partner, and its withdrawal could not be suspended on October 31, 2008. So, unless Your Honors have any further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Richard Rank. I'm from the law firm of Ashby & Geddes. We represent the appellee here, SV Special Situations Fund. I do want to introduce at the council table with me Mr. Andrew Cordo from our firm. Your Honors, I'm not going to rehash the facts. I don't think the facts other than this letter are really in dispute about what time frames happened and what letters came out when and when people invested. So I wasn't going to go back through that. And I had not planned on focusing on the Rule 56H argument that is in our papers. I think it's fairly well hashed out. It's a pretty straightforward procedural argument. So unless Your Honors have questions about that argument, I'll probably just skip straight to the meat of this. Given the mechanics of Rule 56, it's important for the court not to lose sight of the procedure that got the parties to where they are today. Wimbledon, without taking any discovery, chose to stand on the allegations in its complaint and argue, as a matter of law, that it had validly withdrawn from the SV fund effective on June 30th, 2008. SV responded by pointing out to an important omission in Wimbledon's theory, and that was that there was a lockup period of 12 months that had not been waived.
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical.
Sure.
If the letter was written and said, you know, we want to withdraw as of June 30th, and a simple response had been sent back that said, that's fine, would that have constituted a waiver, or are we looking for language that says, that's fine, we'll waive the 1 year? Does it have to be more elaborate? And if you can simply say, that's fine, and the 1 year doesn't apply, explain why this letter couldn't possibly be construed as saying, that's fine.
Sure, Your Honor.
But start first. Is that fine enough?
No, Your Honor. The question you posited, at least as I heard it, was that if we had gotten the letter that they sent saying we want to withdraw as of June 30th, you know, please let us withdraw, and we sent a letter back that said that's fine, I do not think that's enough to show a waiver under our common law of waiver and also under the LP agreement's provisions of waiver. I think had the letter they sent to us or the withdrawal notice they sent to us said, we want to withdraw as of June 30th. We realize that we do not have the right to do so because we are in this lockup period, but would you please let us out? And then we wrote back, that's fine. I suspect that you would be able to put the two of those together and say, yes, that is a knowing consent because you have this, you have that's fine, signed by the party to be charged. That, I think, probably covers it.
Right. All right, then let's look at it from a different perspective. They send a letter that says we'd like to withdraw June 30th. Admittedly, the response from your client was many weeks after June 30th. But if your client's position was you can't withdraw for a year, wouldn't you expect that to have been the content of the letter? Thanks for your letter. You want to withdraw June 30th, but you know that's not possible. You have to wait a year, and we're not waiving it.
That would be the ideal world, Your Honor. And the Vice Chancellor kind of ran us around the ring about that at the oral argument below. And it was, you know, if in a perfect world, if clients, you know, came and got advice from their lawyers and responded in clear ways, we wouldn't have these disputes. But, you know, what they came back with was the letter that we have in the record. And, you know, that's all we have in the record. And because we're at summary judgment, that's kind of where we are. But I do agree with Your Honor. I think that had, you know, I think a much better response by our client, or a much clearer response, would have been precisely the one you posit, is that, you know, we've gotten your letter. You were in a lockup period. We really don't feel like we should waive it, either give a reason or don't give a reason, and then, you know, let the people go on with where they are. The problem here is that both sides were proceeding on an ambiguity and not really knowing where they were.
So what we have is a letter that says, we have your request to withdraw on June 30th. We've decided to give you securities. We'll get back to you. And what you're saying is that there's absolutely no way to read that as a waiver or an agreement, that what is the only possible reading when it says we have your request to withdraw as of June 30th. We've decided to honor the request, give you securities, we'll get back to you. Doesn't it sound like they're proceeding with the request?
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor. I think that first sentence that talks about June 30th is acknowledging, yes, we got your request as of June 30th. And again, this is something that we talked extensively about down below, where the argument could be made, and we think that it's a reasonable inference, and we thought that the Vice Chancellor drew the right inference, that it's acknowledging the June 30th, that you were asking to get out at June 30th, but we are putting you in the...
But here on appeal, your answer to the court is not necessarily. And on summary judgment, shouldn't your answer to the court be absolutely not? Isn't that what we're really focusing on when we're talking about summary judgment?
In most cases, yes, Your Honor. And that's where I think we find ourselves here, is because the substantive issue here is waiver. And we have, you know, clear provisions in this state under the common law that waiver is a voluntary and intentional relinquishment of a known right. It may be expressed or implied, but either way, it must be unequivocal. And a waiver will not be implied on ambiguous acts. And so I think our argument to your...
Well, what's unclear about this sentence? We will provide you more detailed notice as to the time of delivery and the securities to be delivered. Doesn't that mean you're out or your withdrawal is proceeding?
We view that as meaning that you have a pending withdrawal. Because we are acknowledging that we got the letter. Now, you know, as we've talked about a few minutes ago, it's a little less than clear.
Time of delivery relevant?
Well, the time of delivery would be relevant because, you know, we're talking in the fall of 2008 here, and I think, you know, what they're trying to say is that, you know, we've got to figure out what we have, how we can, you know, how we might be able to unwind these things and be able to pay people. And so they're asking you, you know, look, to call us if you want to talk about this, or, you know, we invite you to withdraw this pending request, as the letter says.
Now, this letter was written on September 30th, 2008.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it says the partnership is also willing to accept the withdrawal of pending capital withdrawal request at this point in time?
Yes, Your Honor.
How does that affect a June 30 date when it says this point in time? Does that mean June 30th is indicated earlier in the letter, or does it mean the date of this communication, September 30?
Well, I think the clear reading is as of this date of September 30th. I think, you know, again, this kind of goes back to we don't have a clear letter here, and,
Your position, as I understand it, it doesn't matter whether you construe this to be unambiguous or ambiguous. No matter what inference you could draw from it, in order for it to constitute a waiver of the 12-month lockup, it has to be unequivocal and clear, and this is not.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that comes from, you know, the common law of waiver, plus when we have, you know, an LP agreement that provides, you know, the waiver must be in writing, and then you have an integration clause that says that, you know, any waiver or modification of the terms of this agreement must be signed by a writing, you know, any writing.
What explicitly does the agreement say? I asked your friend that question. She read from the agreement, as I understand it. Does the agreement, in effect, I'll use a wrong term, a bad term, codify the common law, or does it just say it has to be in writing?
Well, I think it takes the common law waiver a step farther, because the common law waiver says that it can be expressed or implied. I think the LP agreement makes it, it takes implied out of there and says that you will not be, you have to, in order to win, for Wimbledon to win, if they ever went to trial, our view is that they will have to show up at trial with a signed writing by the SV fund that says, we expressly consent to your early withdrawal of this agreement. That's what Rule 56 required them to bring forward in responding to our motion, was some type of evidence where the court could see down the road that, yes, there is a rational trier of fact that we'll be able to find for them. And so this is not one of the situations where a lot of the case law and summary judgment where you have competing affidavits or you've gone completely through discovery and, you know, the record on summary judgment is this thick and there's tons of facts where then a court could weigh the facts and say, well, you know, it's like a card game where...
So your position is that in order to create a genuine issue of material fact or a triable fact, they had to be able to show at summary judgment a piece of paper, a writing called for by the agreement that expressly, as the common law would state it, constituted a waiver of the 12-month lockup period.
Yes, Your Honor, and the way we get there is, you know, the actual sections of the agreement, 6.1F, which is in the waiver, or which is in the withdrawal section, says, subject to applicable law, the general partner may, in its sole discretion, waive or modify any of the terms relating to withdrawals pursuant to written agreement with the limited partner or otherwise. This is the language that Wimbledon presented a few minutes ago.
Well, in this case, let's suppose that in response to the letter requesting withdrawal on June 30th, they simply sent these securities. You know, cover letter that says, we have your letter, you want to withdraw June 30th. We've decided that you're going to get securities. Here they are. Would that have been something, would the general partner have done something wrong because the general partner never said there's a waiver? He simply acted and sent the securities?
I think the general partner has that right to do that. I don't know whether they would have done something wrong because I don't know whether whatever how they valued the securities on September 30th.
Now, my question, you're putting a premium on the word waiver or something that's a synonym for waiver. And my question is designed to say if you act and the action would constitute a waiver by any reasonable interpretation, can you have a waiver through action and not express language?
I think you could here in the situation that you posit, Your Honor, because to me, then everything is done. And so I think I would have a hard time coming in as counsel for SV and arguing that I should be able to get my assets back because I didn't mean to waive it. That would be a difficult argument for me to make because I think by then, you know, it's not that your opinion.
Would anybody else under the agreement have an action against the general partner? You know, for delivering these securities without ever invoking the word waiver.
That type of act, I think, might be enough because that's a kind of I view that as a complete act. You not only have you discussed waiver, you've actually done it. You've gone and given them the securities. It's not a discussion, and you're not in the
But in this letter, if we go back to the September letter where it says, we've decided to give you securities, we'll get back, you know, with a list or the specifics, that's not a waiver. So if you actually had sent the securities, it could be a waiver, but if you simply say, we will send you securities, it's not a waiver.
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I think that goes back to where we are and what kind of case we have here. Because this is waiver and because we have, you know, the common law of waiver and because we've got an LP agreement that has, you know, the two provisions that say, the integration clause says no modification or waiver of this agreement or any part hereof shall be valid or effective unless in writing and signed by the party sought to be charged therewith. So, I think that here the vice chancellor was perfectly within his powers to say, I've looked at this letter. This is the only thing you've put in front of me on Rule 56. This is the only card you've laid on the table. Ambiguity does not win for you here, because I will have to be able to see a clear and knowing waiver in writing signed by the party to be charged. Here's a writing signed by the, you know, ostensibly signed by the party to be charged, but there is no clear indication that they were waiving the 12-month lockup. And so ambiguity, I don't think, wins for them. Now, in a lot of summary judgment cases, it very well might, but here I don't think it does.
You said ostensibly. It's not disputed that it was signed.
No, we are not disputing that now. Pardon me, I'm just making sure we've covered all of that. I think we've covered that issue. On the issue of whether this, if you take ambiguity out and then you look and say, well, did the vice chancellor get it right when he says, you know, I read the letter this way?
I have a follow-up question I want to back
up. Sure, Your Honor.
Let's assume that the sending of the letter constitutes a consent. Does, under the agreement, could that be revoked by the October 31 letter of your client?
I think it can, Your Honor. This was another thing. We ran around the ring quite a bit about it, oral argument at the summary judgment stage. And there is a very broad power given to the general partner to suspend withdrawals when it sees that it needs to. And, you know, if you think back to where this country and the economy was in the fall of 2008, it would be very easy to, using your assumption, it would be very easy to, if you assume that you told somebody on September 30th that, yeah, I get it, I'm going to let you withdraw, let us go look at our assets and see what we can do, we'll talk to you about when we're going to deliver them. In a matter of days, much less in a matter of a month, your situation may be very, very different given, you know, the number of people seeking to get out or in the ability to liquidate the assets that you have.
The argument on the other side is the only request was to withdraw as of June 30th. And if there's any way to construe the letter as saying we grant your request to withdraw as of June 30th, then you cease to be a member, and therefore you couldn't stop a distribution because June 30th was the operative date.
Well, I think, Your Honor, I think they could suspend the withdrawal. Then I think the fight became, you know, would become, would the value be done back at June 30th, or would you be getting your securities at some point when you can, or your cash, but, you know, where would the valuation be? I think that would be the fight that we would be having. But we think that they could withdraw, that they could suspend the withdrawals. They had a broad power to do so. At most, we think that this was a pending withdrawal because we had never clearly and had never consented to the withdrawal. And so if it's a pending withdrawal, pending means that you should be, you know, it's not complete.
But if you lose on that issue, do you agree that if the June 30 withdrawal is effective, that they couldn't be suspended in the fall?
Well, I think they could be suspended, Your Honor, and here's why. Maybe I wasn't articulating very well. I think the fight might be about when you're valuing things, but I think you could suspend them because, let's say if you kept things nice and neat and you know, June 30th had rolled around and we're supposed to pay them within 30 days, so we'd have to pay within by July 30th, you get down to July 29th or even July 30th, and you try to sell the assets, or you think you're going to try to sell the assets, and you can't. And you realize you have to suspend withdrawals. I think the general partner, had the power to do that. So, you would be suspending that withdrawal, even, you know, whether it was right when the payment was due or whether we're talking October. But I do think the fight we'd be having with Wimbledon is when that was valued. But here, you know, we feel that between the common law and the limited partnership agreement, it's clear that what Wimbledon needed to bring to the table on summary judgment in responding to SB's summary judgment motion was some evidence from which the court, you know, could look ahead and see, yes, a rational trier of fact will be able to find for you at trial and, you know, bringing one card to the table, which is this September 30th letter, which, you know, they keep calling it deeply ambiguous. I think if you read the transcript, that was merely posed as a question that, you know, the question was pretty long, so the question had changed by the time you got to the bottom, so the answer never was given. But that was a question from the honor, from the vice chancellor, basically asking, well, where does that get you if the letter is deeply ambiguous? And that's what we're arguing here today, is that deeply ambiguous does not win for you, because in this situation and where we are, you need to have a clear, signed, knowing waiver, and there's no way that letter could be read that way. And that's all I have, Your Honors, unless you have questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just a few points on rebuttal. I think it's clear there may be a dispute about Vice Chancellor Strine's discussion and what exactly he meant about deeply ambiguous. I've been back and looked at the transcript on page 13, and it's hard to tell. He starts out talking about the letter and then starts talking about deeply ambiguous, but it was within the same breath that he spoke about the letter and spoke about deeply ambiguous. However, there's no dispute that he described the entire situation as sloppy, and I think that's evidenced by the questions that Your Honors have posed this morning. There's so many questions about this letter. What does it mean? And given that situation, summary judgment was not appropriate. Could I just run back to the table because
sure.
I grabbed the wrong notes?
If we agree and there's a trial, what's going to be presented at a trial other than these documents?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to mention this, but as I think all of your honors are aware, we filed a motion to supplement with other documents that my client discovered after the Court of Chancery proceedings. And there's other evidence out there, I think, that would support the waiver of the one-year requirement. And not only that, but waiver and intent. Waiver is subjective. So the other evidence that we would be looking for is what did SV intend when it sent this September 30th letter.
Do you dispute that there's a common law rule that a party is not charged with waiver unless they clearly and unambiguously or clearly and unequivocally waive their right?
Yes, after trial. I think that is the standard, but that's the standard after trial. And a waiver can be implied by conduct, and it can be conduct such as to warrant an inference to that effect. And I'm taking that from a parenthetical in the Court of Chancery's opinion at note 17.
Okay, I accept that as your position. What if the particular context is that there's a limited partnership agreement which calls for that waiver to be in writing?
It calls for it to be in writing or otherwise.
Yeah.
So, I think the or otherwise indicates that it can be, if it's in writing and it's an inference from the letter that is basically, as Justin Holland characterized it as, you know, can't we read this letter as that's fine?
Well, or otherwise could be his hypothetical, the actual completion of conduct that's consistent with waiver, such as an actual delivery of the securities within 30 days of June 30th. That could be the or otherwise.
Right, it could be. But it's or otherwise. It's not just that it has to be in writing expressly. And I think since your honors are raising this point, and I know you're thinking about it, I would just refer you to the Gradel versus Piranha decision. We cited that below. And in that case, it was a District of Illinois case. It was a very similar case where the limited partner had submitted a withdrawal notice. The general partner tried to suspend all withdrawals after the fact. And the language in the limited partnership agreement said that the general partner may permit withdrawals as of any other date rather than consent to. And the court found that there was no hyper-technical express need for the waiver in that situation.
Yeah, well, your time's run out, okay. Unfortunately. We'll take a look at the case.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise.